For me, fashion is a verb. So it's to fashion.
You're listening to Wardrobe Crisis with Claire Press. Join me every week as we look at sustainability, ethics, and the business and madness of fashion. Regular listeners to this podcast will know that there are some people I get very excited about welcoming onto the show. People who have been on my wish list. And one of them I got this week. We're going to be sitting down with Karen Franklin, journalist, style icon for sure, proud fashion citizen, not consumer, one-time presenter of the very best thing ever to hit British TV screens. I was obsessed with this when I was a teenager, The Clothes Show, and all-time national treasure. These days, her work centres on education and activism. She's actually a visiting professor of diverse selfhood at Kingston. So good. How's that for a job title? And she's got an MSc in applied psychology, where she specialised in selfhood, objectification, inclusivity, and gender bias. Very, very interesting stuff. So this is a conversation about meaning. Codes are about more than just looking nice, of course. We often talk on this podcast about the importance, for example, of how they're made. But this is about considering, taking it a bit further, considering how fashion's meaning stretches beyond supply chains and our wardrobes to shape our culture and the way that we see ourselves collectively. We're asking, how does fashion see itself when it comes to race and privilege and the male gaze? And actually, in that way, it links to the episode that we did a couple of weeks ago with Michaela Stark, all about body image. I actually love how all these conversations, last week's with Richard Malone and the one we've got coming up next week with Rahimur Rahman, they're all kind of looking at different aspects of this, how fashion is really political, I guess. But you know what else? This is just also a really lovely personal interview about a life in clothes. Are you ready to sit down with Karen Franklin? MBE, no less. Ooh, before we dive in, I just want to thoroughly recommend her latest book. It's in audio format only. She co-wrote it with Professor Keon West, and it's called Skewed: Decoding Media Bias, How Bias Distorts Our View of Other People and How to Make It Stop. It's really, really good. I'm partway through. So after you've listened to our convo, definitely hop on the show notes and check out all the links there. Let's go and visit Karen Franklin in London. Karen Franklin. I'm trying to say it in the Welsh way because that's actually how you pronounce it. Welcome to the podcast. You do it for us.
Karen, this is exactly as you said it.
Not that hard. I'm so delighted that I'm finally getting to speak with you. Actually, on the podcast, I told you, I believe, that I have this wish list of people I want to talk to, and you've been on it for years.
Well, I'm thrilled to hear that, and I'm glad that we finally got it together.
The last time I saw you was at the Vin and Omi show. They're very wonderful, very eccentric, and very pioneering in terms of sustainability designers. They've been on this podcast, the first episode of Series 8, but their show was so full of creatures and wonderful people, right?
It was very otherworldly, wasn't it? And they are otherworldly, especially Omi. And I think you sort of go there knowing what you're going to get. You're going to get sort of packed venue with people. I mean, the people I was sitting opposite looked like they should have been in the show.
Well, that's what I was going to say. It is a scene.
Yeah.
And to me, that is the great joy of a really good show, whether it's an emerging designer or someone more established, but we don't see it. I mean, I've just been looking at the couture. That might be deemed a scene, but to me, it just seems like show-offs trying to make money. Whereas this was like underground club culture, London creatures out in force.
Yeah. And actually, but there is quite a magical element to them. You know, they live well out of London in a farm. They've got their own natural dyeing vats, you know, experimenting with, Prince Charles's nettles or whatever they can get their hands on.
But what about who were you sitting near and around? Because the showgoers are always just a sight to behold, aren't they? They're sort of London club people. Whether you know them or not, it's the outfits.
Well, it was amazing. I was actually sitting right next to somebody who had glasses on, but they had false eyes in the glasses.
Yes.
So I can't see them. And it's always hard to see someone's expression, but we're just having a very earnest conversation about their child's recent diagnosis. But they are looking quite cartoon-like, the way they're looking. And then I'm sitting opposite about three people who have come in the sort of full leather or rubber look, all very long-limbed on sort of big platform shoes like stilts, having absolutely no problem whatsoever kind of getting up to hug and kiss other people and not having to carefully lower themselves back down again.
And I do look them up afterwards because I want to see who is this, like you say, magical dresser. Some of them include Polyvinyl. You always see them. You always see Parma Ham, the best, like a goth with enormous platform patent boots and then like extremely great makeup. So what keeps you interested in a designer or the likes of Vin and Omi? You've been looking at, commenting on and engaging with fashion for so long. What keeps you coming back? What are you after? I just slagged off the couture. What do you...
It's actually not the clothes. It's the language that the people in them speak. So I'm a people person and I love the conversations and the expressions of identity that I see in clothing. And of course, I'm excited by skillful creatives. And of course, over the years, I've been in the fashion industry for 42 years now. Over the years, I've had quite intense periods of covering trends, of talking about designers, of promoting emerging talent, but then sort of really moving through it, you know, wanting to hold fashion accountable, sort of thinking, am I the only one who thinks this? Am I the only one who's not happy about this? I'm wanting to sort of gather tools in a way to deconstruct things that haven't had a vocabulary. And maybe I haven't been able to explain to myself. Mm. But as I've become more accomplished, I've been more able to draw attention to things that I think and have thought for quite a while are important. So people will sometimes mistake me for a sustainability expert, but what I'm dealing in is emotional sustainability and the identities of people who wear clothes. So that's anyone. In order to be empowered and be able to speak their truth, and part of that is caring about waste and, you know, environmental pro-social progress.
And other people and how they're treated.
Absolutely.
And the self and how you treat that.
Yeah, no question. Getting to know yourself. I think that's the first kind of liberated sort of move we make in our teens or younger when we say, I don't want to wear that. I want to wear this. And, you know, being able to wear something that inherently your parents are going to disapprove of. Not because it's shocking, but it just doesn't meet their taste criteria. So, you know, I had two very, what would be the word, sort of self-possessed daughters to the point where my first daughter, really after about 18 months, would be, well, I'm not wearing that. But I will wear that pink princess outfit with all those frills and those special shoes with those bows on. And I'm like, I didn't sign up for this, but I also thought she's expressing an opinion.
All right. What since you brought us down to personal choice when it comes to the wardrobe, you are a very considered, I want to say evocative dresser. I feel like you've got a very specific way of being when I see you out at an event. Perhaps it's a bit of a head wrap. Perhaps it's architectural and fascinating. I don't know. Tell us then what your style is, which I hate that question. You know, we never ask, what's your style? but what do you choose to adorn yourself with and why if you're being looked at? And is it different to how you would do it if you weren't?
Yeah, there's a uniform, isn't there? So because I spent so long in front of the camera and because we would have very early starts, we would travel all over the country and there wasn't a Winnebago in sight. You know, it was the BBC, very kind of under-resourced.
What, stuff your stuff in a holdall, take it yourself?
Well, or even just wear it on the train. So you can arrive because there won't be much time and you'll be getting your makeup done in the toilet.
I do actually love that. It seems a very, I like get on with it mentalities. Just wear your outfit on the train.
Yeah.
It's fine.
Yeah.
So what would it have been?
So, well, it will have been whatever I was buying from designer friends in their studio sales at the time. And people would often say, oh, you must have had an amazing budget. You know, you always seem to wear different things. I'm like, no, I'm a good stylist. So I know how to ring the changes with the same stuff. And I had friends who would have, you know, and back in the day, studio sample sales were the way I shot. And it was easy.
And who would those designers be?
Oh, God. So there'd be sort of collective ones where, you know, there would be lots of designers under one roof. So, you know, in the early days, of course, I had Galliano. Of course, John Richmond was a friend, so I wore a lot of his stuff. Of course, I had Vivian Westwood. And often, you know, those would be bought in the sales and it wouldn't be Red Label. You know, it'd be more likely to be Anglomania because that was my price range. And even that bought at end of season. So I'm a canny shopper and always have been. I also make, so I could always alter, I could always change. If you'd have stopped me at any point, there would have been lots of safety pins in what I was wearing because I'm like, that doesn't feel right today. I'm actually just going to bunch it up here and pin it. And then, oh, these boots, that's going to look better now. So I've got a thing about proportion. And I can see very easily when I look in the mirror at my own body what needs to happen. And that makes me feel, okay, right, I'm suited and booted. I know my look works. The head wraps came as a result of just wanting to get my hair under control and not wanting before every take to have somebody coming up with more hairspray and another comb and more brushing and yanking my head about. And it's very fine flyaway
hair. Practical again.
Yeah, it's all practical. That's the bottom line. And anything with pockets, that gets extra marks.
So you were a presenter on the clothes show from late 80s to 1998.
86 to 98. So that was sort of 12 years primetime TV. And we went all over the world through BBC World Service. So we went into the homes of 156 million people way before there was kind of cable TV. So I found it quite strange if I was on holiday and people would say, clothes show lady. I'm like, well, how do you know? But I sort of got used to that. And my daughters both say, out of practice really now, oh, you just smile and say hello to everyone, don't you? And I'm like, well, I don't know if I know them or not. So it's just better to, you know, operate from everybody's my friend because people, for whatever reason, and obviously there wasn't as much telly in those days, even in the UK, there was only 4 TV channels. So we did have, you know, around 10 million, sometimes 30 million weekly. And that was normal.
Let's take a moment to think about how spectacular it is that fashion was on the telly. Because it isn't really now. Of course, it's on dedicated channels. If you can get I don't actually know what it's called, but I think there's a fashion channel. You can sit down and watch fashion shows looping because there's so much choice. But this was, like you say, 4 channels once a week being served up directional fashion into the living room. And I think if you're listening to this as a young person and you're like, what are you talking about? I'm talking about TV that is on at a specific time. So you would, actually we had a magazine called the Radio Times, which is weird because it was about the TV, and you would look at it and it would say 7 o'clock, this is on.
We were on at 5 o'clock.
On a Saturday?
On a Sunday.
Sunday.
And most people didn't have tellies in every house. So, you know, in every room, yes, thank you. So
you're not that old. People did have a telly in the house.
Yeah. But there would be arguments about which side, because the fashion was on the BBC, but the rugby was on ITV. And so I was often told, I won, I got it. But there were also, they did have video players. And Gareth Pugh sort of once said to me, I had to have the clothes show videoed every week. And you know, I'd write on it, you know, this clothes show episode. Said, and if anyone videoed over it, they would be hell to pay.
But it is actually, it was so formative. I was addicted to it. You watched it and it was wonderful. And if you, and I think it did definitely get a lot of people into fashion. And it's funny because when you speak with people about what turned you on to the idea of being a designer, for example, they'll often say magazines and they'll often say Vogue, or they'll say ID, which we should talk about. But this was also something I think that changed, switched a lot of people onto the idea that this could be a career, that these designers were worth knowing about.
I like to think that we did introduce sort of British people to British design.
We did.
When, you know, it's sort of initially in the early days, people would name a whole load of Italian designers, but they couldn't name British designers. So I like to think that there was a sense of national pride about how clever our designers were and how creative they are. I think also people did have a sense that it's not just the ones that are being featured in magazines. It's all of these people that you don't know who are doing their things in little independent studios and who are just producing this kind of incredible, innovative idea of what we can step out in, what we can wear. So, you know, understanding that people like Jean-Paul Gaultier every season would do a London trip before he began his collection to get ideas.
It was also a way to discover fashion characters that you may not have met. And I just, before we move off the clothes show, want to talk about Lou Bowery, because I told you one of my best favorite ever TV clips is you having high tea in Harrods with Lou Bowery. Please explain.
So I had known Lee since ID magazine days. So just to kind of expand on that, my first job out of art school was working at ID magazine. I'd bought it as a student, and that was my dream to go and work there. And so I did, lucky me.
As a stylist?
As a sort of general, because actually the magazine was made in art director, publisher-in-chief Terry Jones's sort of loft. And it was a bi-monthly when I first joined. And we all had to work on other campaigns. He was art director for Fiorucci. So we'd all work on the Fiorucci campaign. And then we'd go, can we work on ID now? And then we'd all be there sort of till late putting it together. And of course, part of my job was going to clubs most nights with a photographer to spot people and what they were wearing and to interview them, to put them in the magazine.
Where'd you go? Where'd
You're
you go?
Welcome.
I mean, what best job ever. Where did you go?
So anywhere from the Wag Club, Camden Palace, Beetroot, Studio 21, there was an amazing club in the Cha-Cha's, you know, in Heaven, where Scarlett, who appeared on one of the covers, who had this incredible hair cross in full colour,
but
bald everywhere else, you know, who was one of our special clothes barometers.
Oh, clothes barometers, the best. But I was just thinking, this is the fashion that I really love and get excited about. It's DIY, it's from the ground up, it's made in your bedroom, it's made for your friends, it's not about how much money you've got, it's delightful.
Well, that's how I actually came into fashion. So just to finish the Lee Bowery story, I knew him from Taboo and his amazing outfits. And, you know, when we talked, he said ID was what kept me going. And Lee Bowery has become a national treasure, the late Lee Bowery, unfortunately. But
he's not yours because he's an Australian.
That's so true.
But it's lovely, isn't it? Because he did live here and he did become this fashion treasure in Britain.
I think Lee became Lee in London. And he said, you know, I was in Melbourne in a burger bar working, and I just thought, I've got to get myself to London. And of course, we'd go to Taboo with a camera most weeks and he would have a different look. We didn't at that point we only did cover girls. And Lee was, I think he was our first cover male. And so by the time I'd got to the clothes show, which was much more conventional, BBC takes a look at fashion across the spectrum, I was bringing all of my Clubland friends in. I was bringing those emerging designers in. And I said to Lee, can we feature you, you know, what you wear all the time to clubs? And also Lee did make. And he used to have a store in Hyper Hyper in Kensington with Rachel Auburn. called spend, spend, spend. So, you know, he would run up an outfit almost weekly. And we just said to him, just come and take tea in Harrods and tell us about your clothes. So it worked really well.
We'll share a link. You can watch it. It does exist on YouTube. But just give us, since this is an audio experience, give us just a vibe.
So full head-to-toe fabric masks with the wildest makeup underneath, just kind of balaclava style, so you could see eyes and mouth, and huge false eyelashes, and then fitted sort of capelets, long sleeves, frock coats, all embroidered.
And the fabric mask matching the whole
Absolutely.
Ensemble, so it's a yeah. uniform print from head to the foot.
Absolutely.
And body morphing into strange upholstered shapes.
You got it.
So good.
Yeah.
But also so funny. Then like marching around, teetering around Harrods,
yes.
ordering tea.
Ordering
with you.
Tea, helping himself to cakes and just telling me what he was wearing. And the way we wanted to play it was we're not saying, whoa, you're really exotic. You know, what are you doing? We were just like, hi, Lee, you're a creative. Tell us what you're wearing. And that's the bit I like the most, really.
Me too. Okay. You mentioned before that sometimes you get mistaken for a sustainability expert, but you see yourself rather differently. But I do think of you as someone who's really pioneered this conversation around ethics in fashion. And I think of you. We all know you have. And you've certainly been involved in that sustainability discussion since the beginning, since many of the people that have been on this podcast, people like Orsa de Castro, people like Safia Mini, who I feel like, did you go with her to Bangladesh?
I did.
I feel like
yes.
I saw a video clip of it somewhere.
I did post that on an anniversary just recently.
So Rana Plaza stuff.
Yeah, so we went a year after, so on the first anniversary, and Safia took, I'd asked her to be a trustee in a campaign that I was doing. And she said, well, let's swap. So you come and support what I'm doing. I think I got the better deal because I did learn a huge amount accompanying her.
If listeners aren't aware of the work of Safia Mini, she has been on the podcast. We'll share a link to the episode, but she was the founder of People Tree and is now an author and all-round sustainability icon. I never use that word because I think it's a horrible word that people just chuck around like, you're an icon. But she actually is.
Oh.
She was the leader, the first person to make fair trade fashion.
Absolutely. And just has this incredible can-do attitude. And so we went to Dakar, we went to sit in a trade union office, and person by person who'd escaped with injuries the collapsed factory came in to talk about their experience and how they were outside every day begging not to go in because the generator wrongly placed on the second floor was shaking the building and the cracks were just getting bigger and bigger. And we also met grandmothers who were looking after their grandchildren and they'd lost the whole middle tier of their earners, you know, their children. And with no compensation at the time that we went, there was some really basic money. But the firms who said they were going to compensate a year later, many of them hadn't. And so we went to kind of expose that in a way. That wasn't the primary reason.
Even though you're a journalist and you're used to hearing people's stories and you've also done a lot of varied work on ethics and the darker side of fashion, maybe latterly, but how did that affect you listening to their stories? Because I've done that before when I spoke with union leaders around the Rana Plaza incident. Mm. It's harrowing, isn't it? So my question is, how did that make you feel?
Well, I was grateful that I didn't cry because I would have...
Make it all about you.
Yeah, I did struggle. How can you not... Because you're asking me to think about it, I am getting emotional. But how can you know, the children came in with pictures of their parents, their dead parents. People came in with terrible injuries. And you really have to steel yourself to try and somehow make this better by telling other people, by amplifying a message that they can't get out to other people.
I raised Safia because she facilitated a workshop in London a few years ago and you were there and you held a workshop presentation. It was interactive, wasn't just a talk, about the work that you've been doing more recently, which is around diversity and inclusion, and is that even a good phrase to use? Because it's such a banal one, isn't it?
I mean, people still use it, but, you know, it is representation and belonging.
Oh, it's much nicer, much better. But I do think it's linked to that conversation we just had around how we feel when we are exposed to fashion's injustices that are meted out against the people who make our clothes, because there's all this injustice and inequity everywhere else too, isn't there?
There is.
Do you want to talk a bit about that?
I've sort of moved naturally into that space of really wanting to represent people, well, fashion users, fashion, and I don't even use the word consumers anymore.
No, me neither. We've got to stop it. But we are still consumers.
We are, but we can be citizen participants if we choose to operate in a different way. I've found it easy, and, you know, this does speak to my privilege, that I did do a lot of buying 25, 30 years ago, and I still fit it all and I kept it. So I understand that I, back in the day, collected clothes that I'm still using. I joined in the Nothing New for 52 Extinction Rebellion about 4 or 5 years ago, just before COVID. And I've actually found that very easy to maintain.
You said the work that you do laterally is around how not consumers, citizen
participants can change their industry, can engage with their industry.
Yeah.
It started first when I moved from ID and went to the BBC. I would suddenly have people coming up, specifically women, saying, but I can't wear those clothes and I need to see something that is right for me.
Oh, this is interesting. Yeah.
So it really alerted me.
Because, sorry to interrupt you, but same when I worked in magazines, that if you work for a title like Vogue, you're showing them clothes that are too expensive and too small and don't fit their lives, and it can make people feel quite angry, actually.
Yeah.
Left out, talked down to.
Excluded.
Excluded, etc.
Yeah. And I felt that quite keenly. I felt it because it was person to person. People didn't know at the time what Vogue fashion editors looked like, but they did know what I looked like. And I suddenly was aware of a whole raft of people who loved the clothes show, who loved the idea of expressing themselves through clothes, but weren't being shown all the choices that they could have. Certainly for me in the early 90s, I became really vocal about unachievable body ideals. We felt very strongly at the clothes show that we could get round the catwalk imagery that we were showing with makeovers. So we began the makeover. We began, you know, and we would be able to go to the shops and get all the sizes. We weren't working with sample garments. And so that was a policy for us, that we did have age, size, body difference representation. But it was educational for me to think, well, why do the fashion industry get excused? Why do they make garments? And as I began to talk to models, that models have to diet into, that models even feel that they're not good enough when they're in a catwalk image.
In 2009, you and the model Erin O'Connor and PR Deborah Bourne set up an initiative to shake things up on that front. It's called All Walks Beyond the Catwalk.
Yeah, we thought nothing's changing. Let's actually make a bit of a noise with a plan. So Deborah was very talented PR. Erin kind of had lots of model experiences that had made her feel really uncomfortable about the way models were treated. She talked about wearing clothes that you had to be kind of sewn into, and then you'd wait ages for the show to start. You couldn't drink in case you couldn't go to the loo. You know, the designers were just kind of, it's all about the show, just deal with it. And I, of course, was being approached in the street and had been quite vocal about a sister's eating disorder, and that, you know, my own understanding about how I was talking in schools and, you know, recognizing that teenagers and our daughters, mums would come up to me in the street and say, my daughter wants to be a model, because suddenly there was a game in the school playground called Clothes Show. And what girls did was walk up and down, make a shape, you know, sing their favorite song.
Oh no, because it's almost like you have actually unleashed a genie by bringing fashion into the living rooms of the nation.
Yeah. What young teenager doesn't think that there's a big wide world out there and maybe she could be part of it? So we started to realize our own responsibility and really just building on that. I mean, I could tell you stories of threatening to resign at clothes show because models that had been picked were too thin. And I was actually like, if this model is going to be in this film, I won't be reappearing in this program, because I felt so strongly about it. So, yeah, we sort of moved to a space where I guess I had got known for speaking about it and challenging the industry to do better. And in 2009, nothing had happened. So I pitched it to the British Fashion Council. Their first comments were, it's going to look like a dog's dinner. We have models that are all the same size for a reason. But if you guarantee us that you will get high-end practitioners on board from makeup artists to designers, then okay, you know, because we wanted to do a pop-up at London Fashion Week. So we did that. We got emerging designers who are a little bit more accepting of things, wanting to change things. And we got them to make sample size outfits for a range of different models. And we included, you know, a model coming up to her 70s. We include a middle-aged model, curvaceous models. Now, as I'm talking now, that's standard, but it wasn't then. And when we launched, we kind of had all this press and all this conversation, and various fashion commentators were saying, well, it's not extreme enough. And we're like, that's exactly our point. Doesn't need to be. We're just talking about life size, where you represent women, you know, across a spectrum of body and beauty ideals.
In that workshop that you took on that day with Safia Mini, you talked about the power of fashion imagery, so also photography. And mm-hmm. I remember really clearly some of the images you showed. And we do know this already, because especially if you work in it, you see it. But when it's all laid out in front of you, it's very confronting to see how one note the beauty ideal is and has continued to be. You say, oh, that's normal now. Mm-hmm. Certainly the conversation is normal. Certainly, people are fed up with it and there's a lot more commentary around it. But yeah, actually, I don't have the stats in front of me, but every show season, a media organisation, I think it's called The Fashion Spot anyway, they tally up how many older models have been in the show, how many non-standard sized models have been in the shows, and they're all dismal figures.
Mm. Yeah, it's still tokenism, isn't it?
But you talked about the power of fashion imagery and its responsibility, or the image maker's responsibility. Mm.
That's partly because as an educator myself, I'm encouraging media students, image makers, but also designers who are casting to think about the imagery that they put out in terms of its ability to say something empowering as opposed to undermining. And so I deconstruct imagery and I've found it a lot easier. I have new vocabulary since I did my Master of Science in Applied Psychology, specifically to tackle certainly sort of leadership, senior leadership teams who were contesting the credibility of what I was saying.
What would they say to you?
So, for instance, I did a big campaign with a high street brand and we used older models. We got amazing feedback. This was in 2011, social networking in its early days. So there was a Facebook page, all women saying, first time I've seen myself and I love, you know, the styling and I'm really looking forward to coming in and buying the range, which wasn't there. It was just a series of photos, but we thought we could develop this. And sort of met round a table with a group of CEOs who focused in on the older model, who was, again, sort of a pensioner, amazing long legs, grey hair. And they were like, is it the hair? What is it about? Why don't we like this? And, you know, I could sort of get this sense of it being shut down. It was going nowhere. And what I realised, and Jane, my business partner, had her hand on my knee under the table and was kind of clenching it, was that they wanted the fantasy girlfriend, not the reality woman, in their campaigns.
Blah.
So, you know, my question to them at the time was, But you're not the one who goes in and buys the dress. You know, your core customer is asking for this. When was the last time you related to the women's wear photos so that it would help you buy women's clothing? And of course, there was that sort of jokey, or, well, I'm not really into women's clothing. But what I felt was that my lived experience as a woman, my experience in the fashion industry, working in women's wear that put on female models and sold to a female audience, was dismissed, because for the male CEOs, it was all about seeing this fashion totty that made them feel really good about themselves. And so that was when I went to psychology to find studies, like a landmark study that was done across 3,000 cross-cultural participants. So it's really massive, and you can generalize, that found that when women looked at fashion images, they looked to make a bond with the model through shared characteristics. And when they did that, they showed an increased intention to purchase by up to 300%. And so had I had that, I could have wiped the floor with them. But it was being in that meeting, which was one of many conversations where it's like, no, we're not feeling it. Let's go back to what we know. You know, let's get a teenager in a bikini. That's the sort of thing we're talking about. And then let's get her into post-production so that we can make sure that she has an even slimmer waist and an even sort of brighter teeth and bluer eyes. And so that's what made me move into that space, to be able to say, I'm going to fight you with science.
Just you talking about the stupid men. It just...
Well, they're biased, and sometimes they don't know what they don't know. And so it's that bias that often prevents people in positions of power from listening to subordinates. And it also renders them oblivious to the knowledge that they don't have and that they need to have.
This continues to be one of the problems that fashion is beset by. We did a podcast ages ago with Sarah Ziff from Model Alliance. I just want to stick on this subject of the power imbalance. When I was researching questions for you, I pulled out some stuff around the Me Too era. It's still going on, right? But post the whole Weinstein debacle. Then there was this Terry Richardson thing. And if listeners are not familiar with Terry Richardson, he's a very famous fashion photographer. He was a pervert acting in plain sight for years. Everyone in the industry knew. People would say, oh, be careful of Uncle Terry. I think he called himself Uncle Terry. He published books of photographs of him carrying on in absolutely inappropriate and revolting ways with young women. It wasn't a secret, but fashion didn't care. Anyway, you wrote about this at the time, and I want to just read out one of the quotes from a piece that you published. It was for Refinery 29 in 2017, and just get you to talk about it a little bit. So the quote is, "Systems where a sense of entitlement fuels the knowing exploitation of the many by the few are in part responsible for this messed up situation. But gender politics and the privilege of masculinity to experience the culture of the male predator, female prey as normal, or observe other disparities such as the pay gap as inevitable, are just as culpable." Do you want to just talk about that?
Yeah. I mean, to chunk it up a bit, we're sort of essentially talking about male gaze, which we've normalized, where often we see the female model with no agency, with no selfhood, so that she doesn't have a story. She's subservient to the gaze, this kind of, am I shaggable? Do you still fancy me? The sort of pouty fashion totty, where she's essentially selling clothes to women. And I'm thinking myself, when I'm looking at these images, well, I don't want to shag you. I just want to see what you're wearing. But we've all gotten used to this, that it's somehow a really empowered look. But most of the models bring this look as a question. Do you find me beautiful? And I found it really shocking in the Balmain ads where Cindy Crawford and Naomi Campbell and Claudia Schiffer were photographed, but they were sort of in pre-orgasmic mode. And Cindy's even sort of leaning right forward and holding one bosom, like, here's my gift to you.
Oh, God.
And I'm like...
To who, though?
To the viewer.
Yes, but we don't want it.
But there is an assumption that all women will fall in line with this type of imagery. So,
but is it because we're presumed to be desperate to have that same effect on men?
I think that's how photographers might justify it, but I think it's much more narcissistic than that. I think it's a simple, I'm in a studio with a babe, and I can get her to do anything I want. Come
oh,
on,
no.
Let's sizzle. Let's come on,
and
give me some.
And you know what? That goes back to all that 60s stuff,
yeah.
Doesn't it?
Yeah, and that's exactly what Terry Richardson was about. But there would be a lot of, obviously, manipulation, which was much, much more exploitative.
When I said that, that goes back to all that 60s stuff, I was thinking about that film Blow Up. Like the archetype of the man about town photographer who could get all the birds.
The actor David Hemingway. It was modelled on the David Bailey type archetype, wasn't it? Yeah, I remember that. I remember watching
but
that.
So if we are simply accepting or not questioning this visual trope,
mm-hmm.
What does it deliver us?
A huge gendered mind control. If we take this right the way through, then boys who grow up on this imagery see women as subservient, see women as in association to men. And of course, that gets taken into the office space. Studies show that when we see a human being in a state of undress, and we can also see men in a state of undress, but far lesser, that the brain actually awards them what's called lesser moral agency, lesser intellectual status, so that what happens is we're conditioned to seeing women who are not given intellectual credibility. Women have internalized that. So they're often underconfident. They present skills in a world that has told them since they were little girls that they'll never be enough. And so they under-evaluate themselves in workspace situations, whereas men over-evaluate themselves, studies tell us. But there is this confidence then, this swagger, that is often mistaken for competence. So men benefit there, but women are far worse underserved by the law when you take this to its logical conclusion. So I tracked down a forensic psychologist on Twitter, and I actually did interview him for my book, Skewed, Decoding Media Bias, which came out last October. It's an audiobook. I interviewed him for print, but I also, again, interviewed him podcast style. And what he does is he creates real life situations. So the key to a psychological study is that the people in that study don't understand what the psychologist is looking for. Otherwise, they engage in what's called demand characteristics. They give the psychologist what they think that person wants.
Wow, okay.
So it's all made. So he was able to recreate juror situations in a jury setting. And people genuinely thought they were doing trial jury service. And he was recreating a rape trial. So he had actors playing the parts. And he did psychometric testing on the jurors to find that those who engaged in what's called rape myth acceptance, which is pretty much that women are undermined, women are victims, they should have done this, they should have protected themselves.
She shouldn't have worn that.
They are also far less likely to believe women when they speak their truth, because, of course, we've got all of this imagery that sets women up as sexually provocative. And then we've got this psychological disposition that undermines female credibility. And so basically his findings were he could predict who would find against a woman in a credible rape trial situation.
What's chilling about what you just said is that we can all imagine how that might play out in a courtroom, but that it links directly back to the world that we work in, and we have perpetuated it.
And we continue to do so when we see fashion in a bubble. and like, well, this is just, this is edgy. This is what fashion does. If you don't get it, you're just not on our level. You're not cool enough. And fashion does like to shock. Fashion does, you know, it has this one goal to get your attention in a really crowded sort of landscape. And often the go-to visual is a very attractive, unclothed woman.
You might remember, because I don't, who shot those Vogue pictures of a woman. I feel like she was at an airport being tied up and searched. I don't even know if this was in your presentation, but I'm definitely Italian Vogue, bound and gagged. I don't know, police standing on her back. Edgy. I mean,
misogyny, but beautifully styled.
Beautiful clothes, but designed to provoke. How far can we push it? How far can we go? And when we think about the recent debacle with Balenciaga in a different way, that's the same thing. And they would say, oh, we don't know how it happened. Yes, you do. You were trying to be as push it as far as you could.
But and you didn't know what you didn't know.
And you thought that you were so entitled that you thought you would get away with it because people think you're wonderful, darling.
And, you know, enter Terry Richardson again, who was a big creator of that type of imagery of women objectified as bodies, as body parts, to the extent where, you know, even a brand aimed at young women, American Apparel, often contained these really dodgy images of very young girls in sexual positions in their bedrooms.
So you do workshops with brands and people in leadership positions. What are you trying to get fashion creatives to do and see?
So the joy for me is empowering women to give them a vocabulary to be able to say, if you're part of a creative team, you know, mood boards are created, the lighting is done, and there's a few test shots, you get a sense of what's being done. One person in the creative team only has to say, do you know, I'm not feeling right about that. Because we are pack animals, because someone has said something, other people are like, yeah, I was feeling that, but I didn't really like to say, you know, that one person who's willing to say, why have we asked the model to do this? She looks so disempowered, brings other people into the conversation. So I'm definitely empowering women and young men who, via my daughter's choices of boyfriend, I know they're all out there, they're all evolved, they're all talking about this, but they go into an industry that says, yeah, but we do it like this. And if you want to be a part of the in-group and get these opportunities with these people, then you'll just have to suppress your concerns about. So, and that's how that sort of group effect of us all overriding our own kind of internal dialogue to fit in with people who we view in a kind of higher or more authoritative position.
It does come back to power though, because challenging power is very difficult. And if you haven't got any, sometimes you can't.
I had that question, exactly that question from a student yesterday, to which my answer is, I'm not asking you to kind of break down these barriers single-handedly, but I'm asking you to leverage the currency that you have as a younger, up-and-coming, more evolved generation who's actually passing information between each other and saying, we like this campaign because, so we're all going to pass this around, but we're not touching this campaign because it's so out of touch.
It's not just about gender, though. It's also about race, isn't it? How do you want to talk to us about how you've evolved your learnings on race and privilege over the years?
Oh, thank you for asking.
I wrote that one down.
I was lucky enough, let me see, around 35 years ago, to meet my late partner and to be challenged by him.
He was documentary maker, wasn't he?
He was a film writer.
A writer.
So I met him when he was writing a film called Young Soul Rebels, which went on to win the Critics' Prize at Cannes. By that time, he was too ill to go because very quickly after meeting him, he was diagnosed with multiple sclerosis, and it was an incredibly fast decline. So we did have a relationship that was quite emotionally chaotic because there were a lot of things to deal with, not least my white privilege plus my middle class privilege. And so, yeah, there were fireworks. So he was a mixed race, Hackney born and bred, sort of Sussex University educated writer, film writer.
And was being a white woman in a relationship with him something that you discussed, or was it irrelevant? And now did you think it was irrelevant? And now you look back on it and see it as a power imbalance, or I don't know.
Well, it's interesting that yes, probably because I was in the heart of London, I was in clubs, amazing mixes of people. And so being in a mixed relationship didn't seem noteworthy. But actually, that's where I was wrong, because I was sort of coming at it with very little vocabulary around race, power imbalance, and not really willing to start with to see all of the learning that was in front of me, partly because well, we all do, don't we? We want life to run smoothly. And it's very hard to hear that you are part of an oppressive kind of system.
But also your life wasn't running smoothly because of his sickness and what you're going through anyway. I mean, it's not like you're going to be saying, let's sit down and discuss unconscious bias.
Well, certainly that was part of our existence. Not let's sit down. It was much more inflammatory than that. I think, you know, looking at it now, I'm looking at this from, you know, a very long lens now. You know, this is an illness at that time where there was absolutely zero support. There was come back when you need a wheelchair, there's nothing we can do. And so, of course, you would rage at the world and your lack of power. And of course, if that was repeatedly you were reminded of that in much smaller things to do with your own sense of who you are and the racism that surrounds us all, then of course you might let rip with a kind of bigger tirade on something that you feel you could change. So it was fireworks in our relationship. But we had a daughter together. That was my desire to give us a future that was very positive. But Matilda's father, the health decline was so rapid. When I was pregnant, I was saying, please write to this baby, because he was losing the ability to talk. And so there was a lot of race learning, but there was a lot of health privilege learning at the same time. So that really kind of did set me up back then to recognize that coming forward, as it became a bigger part of our vocabulary, culturally, you know, when we looked at the murder of George Floyd and the world, we were just in the right position, having all stopped with nothing to do, to see the truth of this and to see what people of color have been saying forever and ever. And so I sort of made an internal commitment to myself that I would be more effective in that space. I was part of talks around face fashion academics, creating equality, which is very much a kind of academic organization. But that's where empowering creatives to be culturally competent, and especially empowering white creatives to recognize the lack of inclusion in creative teams. Some of these, you know, they've been called out, the sort of Gucci blackface jumper, the Dolce & Gabbana insult to the Chinese community, the pizza.
It's also bad. The Prada keyring fob, H&M monkey sweatshirt.
Yeah.
It's just, it keeps happening.
It keeps happening because they're all white teams, and because nobody in that team understands the racism that they're perpetuating. Simple as that.
Do you want to just really briefly try to explain unconscious bias to us?
So the brain likes patterns and it likes rules, so that it doesn't have to be hypervigilant about every decision it's going to make.
Okay.
So that can be really helpful. We can see someone in a uniform and know that because they're wearing a certain uniform, either we've got to move our car really quickly, or if we're doing something illegal, we better stop doing it. So
we're safe or we're in danger.
Yes. So, and the brain...
No, but hang on a minute. If he didn't get that one, listeners, from the same uniform.
Very good point. I salute you on that. That was perfect. So the brain likes familiarity and it likes to make quick decisions. So it brings together all these patterns and all these stereotypes to serve as a very quick judgment. And because of the culture we live in, those patterns may be about gender formats, maybe about race inequality, maybe about class assumptions, maybe about heteronormative patterns, maybe about disability, body difference, simple cultural things that we'll have grown up with where the baddie always had a scar on his face. Yet people are often disfigured or have their faces changed by accidents. So what are we saying? You know, so all of these patterns the brain since childhood has absorbed, but we're not aware. Oh, I'm thinking in a way that's using stereotypes. So it's unconscious. So unconscious bias is a nice way of saying you're operating with stereotypes, without any understanding of the damage that you're doing.
You're the best explainer of these things. I want to ask why you went to study psychology, because it's obviously been so brilliant in terms of being able to bring all this stuff to bear on fashion. And now are you still teaching at Kingston?
I'm still a visiting professor at Kingston.
But and we're running out of time, but just tell us what made you think I'm going to do this?
I just got to a stage where I was really discontented with the way things were. And in the past, I'd always brought into the room feminism and compassion and empathy. Can we change things? But I just thought, well, actually, for the most part, all of the leadership teams that I'm dealing with are without feminism and without compassion.
And actually, you did tell us that wonderfully evocative story of trying to tell these men in charge that you were doing something that was going to work. And they were like, not listening.
Oblivious.
Now you've got the ammunition.
So I went to get some science. And so I can now say, instead of you fucked me right off and I'm just not going to work with you anymore, I can say, well, studies show.
Yes, this is so good. We've run out of time. And yet this has been the best interview. I absolutely love it. I want to, and thank you for sharing your insights. I just want to ask you one more thing that we might end on, because it's part of this, but another one that people can't grapple with. You said to me, I'm about to go and see a screening of a film. It's about Karens. Very different how you pronounce your name, by the way. Also different spelling.
Thank you so much.
What's the film?
It's called Deconstructing Karen. And it is about looking at white privilege, specifically through the eyes of women, talking to women. Mm-hmm. And what often happens is because we think of ourselves as nice people and we look around at our friendship circles and we think, well, they're nice people and we're all nice white people together, we find it very hard to take on board that we're also racist. So I will happily self-identify as racist based on my acculturation to a white-centric or white supremacist culture. Mm. And I am willing to recognise that there are things I haven't understood and there may be microaggressions that I'm still perpetuating that I don't want to do, because I genuinely do desire equality for us all.
Should we end on how do we be a good ally in whatever area we're looking at? Because I think that is one of those words that...
Yeah.
I was just walking through a store before and it was like pride merchandise. And I thought, oh God, we're commodifying all this stuff. And you probably got a t-shirt that says ally. But what does it really... No, not you. Oh my God. No, it's a nod. Nor do you have a bag with a rainbow on just for this month. But... do you want to end on that about how we can be genuinely effective allies and keep doing the work to change and fight those biases, prejudices, racisms, all the isms that occur within us?
That's such a good question. And I'll try and make it short because I know that we are running out of time. So I think allyship is the first space for listening and empathy and recognizing other people have different experiences and what can we learn from that. But I think the next space is coalition. And Emma Dabbery says that in her book, What White People Can Do Next, which is where we are in it together, recognizing the benefits for all of us. Because I think there's something about allyship which is slightly benign, which is, I'm being a nice person here and I'm helping because it's difficult for you people over there.
Oh, God.
Whereas with coalition, I do not want inequality for anyone because of the way it impacts me, because of the knowledge I lose out on. If I'm a business person, because of the lack of understanding I have of new markets, of new identities that I might want to appeal to, and also because I want to appear culturally competent. I want to do my best self. I want to be my best self when I'm learning from other humans. So I think if we're all recognizing that if we're in coalition together and we are empowering ourselves with new learning, where can that take us? Well, absolutely anywhere. And that's the exciting thing.
This has been an exciting thing. Thank you very much for inviting me into your house. This has been very splendid indeed.
My pleasure.
Still love the clothes show. Never stop loving it.
Thank you for listening to Wardrobe Crisis. You can find the show notes for each episode over on our website, www.thewardrobecrisis.com. And that's where you can also sign up for our free sustainable fashion newsletters. I hope you've enjoyed the show. I'd love you to help us spread the word. Tell a friend, share on social media, or leave us a rating and review in Apple Podcasts. It really helps new listeners find us on the app. You can get in touch with us on social media. The show is on Instagram, at The Wardrobe Crisis, and I'm on there too. And on Twitter, I'm at Mrs. Press. Because I love you.